My next question is something that I don't really get to ask many people, especially many designers. What was prison like?
Frankly, it's a bit shit.
Today I speak with designer, climate activist, and my good friend, Sam Griffiths.
We hit 40 degrees in London for the first time, and there were wildfires in and around London.
And that led Sam to question his role as a designer.
I could continue doing that my whole life and not really shift the needle. I thought I had to do something more than that to really make something meaningful happen.
Sam joined the environmental activist group Just Stop Oil and took part in the climate protests in London, where he got arrested and jailed for 21 days. This is a story of a designer who stood up for what they believed in, despite the consequences of those actions.
A lot of the work I've done, looking back on it, there's some things I'm very proud of, but there's a whole lot of it that was just about making the economic wheel turn. And that's not good enough right now, because just making the economy turn is just perpetuating the status quo that is destroying everything.
I expect this conversation to be pretty polarizing. It might deeply resonate with you, or maybe it might rub you up the wrong way. But please do hear Sam out, because it takes a lot of courage to do what he's been doing. And if you're passionate about a cause, but you've been feeling too alone to do anything about it.
The question is, you know, what can we do? I'm just one person. And the answer is, don't be one person.
Sam Griffiths, welcome to Design Feeling. How have you been?
I've been very well. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to get a chance to chat to you. And I feel very honored. So thank you very much.
Great to have you. You've been a keen supporter of Design Feeling and my work, even before I started the podcast. And I think it's my honor to finally have you join us in the hot seat today. So Sam, imagine that they made a movie out of your life. Where would that movie start? Describe that first scene, the opening scene of the movie.
Well, I don't know. It feels like my life is in two parts now. I'm now like very involved in activism. And up until the summer of 2022, I wasn't. So it sort of feels like that was a crux moment for me in terms of a lot of things changing. So I think if you're going right to the heart of it, I think it would be July 2022, which wouldn't it be when it started?
Okay. And why did you pick that date?
Because that's the date when we hit 40 degrees in London for the first time. And there were wildfires in and around London. Wanstead Flats, like only a couple of miles down the road from us, was on fire. And I was cutting up pieces of cardboard to block skylights and windows to keep the temperature down. And I just had a very visceral insight into my son's future. My son was 12 at the time. And I just knew that this was a temperature that wasn't predicted for the UK for, you know, we should be hitting this until like 2050, you know, for kind of more conservative, like assumed paths for how climate breakdown goes. So to suddenly hit that in the summer of 2022, it just scared the shit out of me. I don't know if I'm
absolutely
on the podcast. Great. Okay. So yes, it scared the shit out of me, and it's something, you know, climate collapse, climate breakdown, the crisis we're facing. It's something I have lost sleep about for years, and have done bits of, you know, signed petitions and went to my MP, and I've gone to the odd demo, but. Once that moment had happened, I felt I couldn't, I had to do more. It was just really stark, and I just felt it very deeply. And then I was, from that point on, I was looking for a way to connect to something that was much more meaningful in terms of action.
Mm-hmm. So that was basically a twist in your movie, pretty much, let's say, right? That's where your new story actually started in that movie.
Mm.
How was life like before then?
Well, it's quite a lot of life before then, because I'm quite old. So I'm 48. So, I grew up in the Northeast, had a very pretty nice childhood. I studied graphic design in Glasgow for a BA, and then did an MA down in Brighton, and then started to work in branding. So the first company I worked with was called The Partners, and they were quite big. But I was just an intern there, and then worked in different scales of organization, like 4, 5, 6 person teams, and then companies of upwards of 100. So I had quite a lot of experience of working in different places. And towards the end of my time working in branding, I did do quite a lot of freelance work. So I think, and then I did a stint at a place where I was doing quite a lot of corporate stuff. And I stayed there for about a year. And then I realized I had to do something different, because something about it wasn't resonating with me. And I've got a much clearer idea about what it was now. But at that time, it just didn't feel right. And so I then started working at Red Badger, where we have both worked, which is a tech consultancy. And I was working to manage their brand. And at the same time, I was launching my own business. So I was working several days a week for Red Badger and a couple of days a week on my stuff. And I set up something called Griffix, because my name's Griffiths and I make graphics, so it's Griffix.
That's pretty clever.
Which is terrible. And because I've always been very interested in play and its connection to creativity. And I wanted to see whether it would be possible to use play to help other people access their creativity. Because I'm really interested in having ideas myself, but it's really exciting when you get other people having them. So I got very interested in that and ran lots of workshops and community projects based off of that. Lots of it, all within London, and quite a lot of it, like very locally to me in Northeast London. And it was great. I really loved it. And I felt very connected to it. And then this moment hit and I realized it wasn't enough. So I could continue doing quite, there were the workshops I was doing, quite a lot of it was addressing climate, and it was using recycled materials, and it was about raising awareness. But I thought once I'd realized the gravity of our situation, I realized that I could continue doing that my whole life and not really shift the needle. And I thought I had to do something more than that to really make something meaningful happen.
So walk us through what was going on through your mind now that you've had that, you had that visceral moment where like, okay, you know, it's 40 degrees in London, which is pretty much like, I know it was like unprecedented. What was going on through your mind in terms of like, why did you want to do this from that point onwards?
Well, the first thing that struck me was how little that impacted the media. So I'm feeling like a visceral panic about we're in this situation and my God, we got to do something. And then that is completely not reflected in the media, and certainly not in government, in the actions and inactions that the government were part of and continue to be part of. There was just such a disconnect from the reality I was experiencing and this other reality around me. And so I was desperate to find people who felt the same way and felt the same urgency. So it was a huge relief just seeing Just Stop Oil like taking action and taking this like really seriously and talking about it in the terms that I could recognize, like in terms of the gravity they were taking it or communicating it with. So that just, it really resonated. And I thought, right, I've got to find out more about what they're doing and how they're doing it and can I get involved? So my immediate reaction was like, I've got to do something and then connect to something. The Just Stop Oil were there and that's what I latched onto.
Okay. So for those of us, you know, who don't know about Just Stop Oil or we haven't heard of them, if you could maybe give us a 30-second elevator pitch of who they are and what they do.
Yeah, sure. If you've not heard of Just Stop Oil, I'd be surprised because we've been pretty active. But the elevator pitch is it's about stopping all new fossil fuel licenses, you know, consents and licenses. So that means not commencing any new projects. So any new oil exploration in the North Sea, or any new coal mine, or any new natural gas. We already have like 8 years worth of reserves of oil, like with what we already have. So we don't need anything new. We've got more than enough to get us through a fair transition. And we have to call a halt at some points because there's just, we're just insanely putting more carbon into the atmosphere and that's just going to continue to warm us. So this is longer than an elevator pitch. So that's the demand. There are kind of supplementary demands, but the core demand is to end all fossil fuel like exploration and new projects from happening. And the way we're doing that is through civil resistance. So it's not just pitching up at a demo on one day and then saying, okay, that's fine, well, I've done my bit. It's about being in resistance to a government that we know is criminal and is in the midst of perpetrating a genocide, frankly. So
could you elaborate on that?
So it's called genocide by implied oblique intent. So our government know that the combined actions and inactions of the status quo are going to lead to hundreds of millions of deaths. And these deaths are preventable. So if we change course, we can prevent all of this. And what's maddening is that they know it's going to happen and they are doing nothing to change that course of action. So it's not like... So the thing that's different about the genocide that the Nazis perpetrate is they built ovens specifically for the purpose of extinguishing life and extinguishing a people. What's happening now is that the conditions just happen to have arisen that will kill hundreds of people. And it is genocide because the government refuses to take the action that it knows will save those lives. And it's not just the government, it's finance, it's insurance, it's the media. There's a whole web of complicity that is leading to this genocidal situation. So it's a big part of what we're doing now is highlighting the individuals who are responsible. So Rishi Sunak at the head of our government, Wael Sawan, who's the CEO of Shell. These are key figures that we must pinpoint and make it really clear that these people are responsible for these like the worst crimes imaginable. And we have to make the public realize that they're happening. Because obviously, you know, the BBC is not telling us this. So we're having to do an awful lot in terms of raising consciousness just about the severity of the situation we're in, but also like there are crimes being perpetrated and these people and this in our current system, these crimes are not even being investigated, never mind prosecuted. But on the flip side of that, the people they are investigating and prosecuting are the people doing their best to highlight this situation. So those of us in Just Stop Oil and in other organizations are being, laws are being specifically written to repress our action. And, you know, we're seeing many arrests and we're seeing people thrown in prison because of this repressive state that we're living in. And this is because our government is not acting in our interest. It's acting in the interests of fossil fuel, you know, and the kind of the fossil fuel kind of status quo. And the core purpose of government is to protect its people. And this is fundamentally where it's failing. So it's not just failing to protect us. You know, this is gonna profoundly affect our lives. But it's also consigning millions of people to death, you know, through its actions.
So, I mean, I can definitely, you know, feel your passion for this issue and how much you care about this. So there's quite a few organizations, you know, that are working actively on this issue. What led you to, you know, pick or be part of Just Stop Oil?
I was very moved by how they're taking action. So all our action is fundamentally non-violent. It's about civil resistance. So it's putting your body in the line and putting your body in the way of harm. With all the risks that incurs from angry members of the public to repression from the state and fines and imprisonment. But it's incredibly, I find it incredibly eloquent morally, you know, that people will put themselves through that because it's so important. I think for me, it communicates just the severity of the situation. I'd seen video of people doing various bits and bobs, like blocking roads and occupying oil refineries and what have you, and seeing them risking arrest and everything. And I thought I'd really want to be brave enough to like take that kind of action. I was inspired by that level of commitment, and like active love, really.
Mm. And you then, you know, were part of some of the protests. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I first got involved in actually taking action in October of 2022. And during that phase, we were blocking roads in and around London. So focusing the protests on the seat of power in the capital. So I was involved in three different roadblocks during those events. And I was arrested all three times, and all of those cases have now gone to court. The first of which, so I didn't know I was going to get arrested three times during that phase. The first time I took action was on October 2nd, and we had a march going from central London down to the river. And when we reached Waterloo Bridge, we stopped and we blocked the bridge. And it was over quite a long time. Then people just sat down and some lay down, and it was quite quiet. It was quite dignified. And then it was made clear that anyone who was going to stay in the road was going to risk arrest. And those who didn't want to risk arrest, they should move to the side. And so lots of people moved to the side and quite a few people stayed. And I was just on the curb, and I was sort of in an in-between space. And I had 20 minutes while people were being arrested to have a think about like what I was going to do and what kind of step I would take. And I was just deeply moved by the people taking action there, which was, there was a couple of people who work in the NHS and they had their blue scrubs on, and there were a couple and they were just sat down in the road and they were just hugging. And it was just something quiet and quite dignified about it. And I thought, over those 20 minutes, I thought, well, yes, I think I could stay. And then I did. And I was, this was towards the end of it. And I think maybe 40 people got arrested on that day. And I was one of the last, and quite a few of us, we wouldn't walk to the vans. I also asked the police officers to carry me, which they weren't very happy about because they were knackered by this stage. But so I got carried to the police van and then taken down to South Croydon, I think it was. But it was all quite gentle, and the police officers were briefed to be quite respectful of us because I heard the briefing before they came in to arrest us. So I had a very gentle introduction to taking action and being arrested. And I had some time in the moment to think about it. And then in the cell, I had some time to like really digest it. And coming out and seeing the other people who'd been arrested at the same time, there was, what we do is we make sure there's always police station support. So people who have been arrested, when they come out, there's somebody there with a mug of cocoa and some biscuits and a nice friendly face, just to make sure people are okay and they can get home. Because often you're released, you know, in the middle of the morning, maybe 3 o'clock in the morning and stuff. And this was, I think we were probably, about maybe a bit earlier, maybe 12 or 1 or whatever. So the person there were two people there. They looked after us, and then one of them drove and was able to drive us to the station so we could get home. Okay. It was really lovely, and it just makes you feel really held.
So, Sam, my next question is something that I don't really get to ask many people, especially many designers. What was prison like?
Frankly, it's a bit shit. I got arrested most recently in the last action phase we had, which was from the back end of October through November to the start of December. And we were slow marching again in the city. And I was arrested on the second march of the action phase. And it was on Cromwell Road, which is a road that leads to the Natural History Museum. And I'd been marching about 15 minutes. And then there was about 50 of us in the road, and everyone who was in the road was arrested. And then held overnight and woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by the desk sergeant and a detective saying, we're going to push really hard to remand you. And then explained their rationale. And then the next day I was in court and it didn't go well. The magistrate asked the prosecutor, so what were you doing about bail conditions? And, prosecutor kind of checked his notes. He didn't seem to be too bothered either way, but he said, oh no, yeah, we'd like to push for remand. And then the magistrate talked through with all the other options that were available to him, such as putting me on a tag, and like, which is effectively house arrest, or excluding me from certain parts of the city or what have you. But he asked me, the key question was, are you going to, reoffend before this next court date? So the next court date would be 28 days later. And in my mind, I knew I would reoffend because I'd gone out that day to be arrested for the first time. But I wanted to be arrested multiple times during that action phase. So there's no way that I could honestly say that I wasn't going to reoffend. So what I did, I explained to the magistrate why I'd taken that action, and that I'd only been in the road for 15 minutes. And you know, this was just exercising what has previously been a long-held British freedom of marching. And he said, okay, that I think you're dodging the issue. Would you re-offend? And then I took a few seconds to think about what my response was going to be. And then the judge said, from your silence, I understand what your answer would be. So I'm going to put you on remand. And then he said, you'll be remanded to the next court date, which was November 28th. This was November 2nd. So so this would be, the court date was November 30th, sorry. So it would be 28 days. But he said, legally, we can hold you until May. So that's 6 months. Wow. Because that offence now under the new Public Order Act 2023, marching in the road now, is punishable with a 6 month sentence. It could be longer than that because the law is untested at the moment because it's so new. But yeah, this is the Public Order Act that came out in 2023 was written by Policy Exchange, which are a think tank, a right wing think tank, which is fossil fuel. It's basically funded by fossil fuel companies. They drafted that legislation. Rishi Sunak has actually thanked them publicly for their work on it. So this deeply repressive and I would say fascist legislation, because it doesn't allow for free speech. It doesn't allow for real effective protest. So effective protest means disruption on some sort of level, because that's where its leverage is. And if you can't protest effectively, then no protest is possible. And so we're in actually, frankly, quite terrifying situation now where effective protest is all but banned and punishable by prison. So cut a long story short, I was remanded. So this means I wasn't found guilty of anything, but because of the risk of me reoffending, they felt that the risk was so great of that they needed to put me in prison. So I ended up in Wandsworth prison, and Wandsworth isn't great. So most British prisons aren't very good, but Wandsworth is one of the worst ones. It's a remand prison, so most of the people in there haven't been found guilty of anything. They're waiting for their court, their cases to be heard. Yet. They haven't been convicted, no. I was then in Wandsworth prison for 3 weeks, for 21 wow. days. So I got out a bit earlier than the 28 days. And it was quite an education. You know, it's very revealing to see how society treats people that it doesn't consider desirable. It's also quite shocking. It's really quite grim. And I think, the conditions in remand prisons are pretty terrible because they're very overpopulated. You know, the Wandsworth prison was designed by the Victorians. So it's 170 years wow. old. And the Victorians actually designed those cells for single occupancy. And every cell in Wandsworth is occupied by two people. Wow. And when you go into your cell, when I went into the cell, I couldn't quite believe that two people would fit, you know, never mind spend most of their time in that space. And it was filthy. I'm just getting used to the idea of sharing with this person I met literally 5 minutes ago, Dave, who happened to be really a very pleasant guy, actually. But that's complete lottery. You know, you have no control over like who you're going to be sharing with. And I ended up sharing with three people over the course of those 3 weeks, moving from different cells and different wings. But I looked out on all of them. So Dave, Peter, and Devon, who I shared with, were all very considerate and calm, which was a huge blessing. But nevertheless, it's quite something to come to terms with when you walk into the cell and then you're trying to process how tiny it is and what have you. And then the door closes and you just got to get on with it.
What was going on to your mind at that point, like when the door closed?
Well, I since I got in there and since I didn't expect that magistrate to come to that conclusion. So this is, putting people in jail for marching is an extraordinary thing, and it's not happened before, and no one really expected them to go down this route. So I wasn't prepared kind of emotionally for this. So I was in shock for the first 24 hours. But I did do a lot of work through that time, just in terms of controlling my breathing so that I could kind of remain as calm as possible. And the thing that seemed to be key for me through the whole experience was, while I was calm, I was able to cope. It was very important to me that I kept a rein on things, like emotionally, and just regulated as much as I could. So there is one really simple breathing technique, which is just to, you know, take deep breaths, but make sure that your out breath is longer than your in breath. And it's a great hack for getting out of fight or flight response. And then it gives you a bit, if once you're out of that, you can actually get above the lizard brain and actually engage the frontal lobes, and, you know, you can think rationally. So that really helps, you know. So calming down in those first 24 hours was about breathing. And then over the next few days, it was about doing yoga in the mornings to try and give like a bit of calm and clarity in the mornings, and then take that through the day. And then gratitude, like doing gratitude exercises.
What were you grateful for?
The first time, so much. The first time I did that was the first time I got out for exercise, which was about, I think, the fifth or sixth day in there, because we were in effective lockdown, which meant we didn't get out of the cell more than an hour a day for those first few days. But once I did get out for exercise, I also found that initially quite stressful, because that was the first time I was in amongst a big group of people, because I'd spent all of the time just in the cell. But what I did was, in Wandsworth Prison, in the prison yard, you walk anti-clockwise, because everyone does, and it doesn't change every day. It's always anti-clockwise. Because there's not a lot of space,
and it's a one-way traffic.
If you walk the other way, it's one-way traffic. Yeah, but it's one of these things that there's so many rules in prison, but they're just the things that very little of it is explained. You just got to pick it up as you go along. But one of the rules is you walk anti-clockwise in the exercise yard. But it becomes quite hypnotic, just going round and round and round. And I started doing this gratitude exercise while I was walking, and the combination of the two was I found quite profound. But I was, you know, initially I was thinking about my son and my wife and the life we have, and stroking my dog's ears. I thought a lot about food that I loved, because the food in there is like pretty awful. So it was lots of, you know, big things emotionally, the people that are important in my life, my family and friends, but also very small things. After doing that for about 20 minutes and having this kind of hypnotic walking round and round, this incredible, profound calm just came down on me. It was amazing. And I was literally beaming, you know, which must have looked quite odd, but it was, I found it a very profound experience, actually. And it taught me a lot about, you know, where resilience comes from. I was profoundly grateful for it, actually. So simple things like that helped a lot. But another thing that really helped was, I received a huge amount of mail, letters and cards and emails. And it was just fantastic to have that connection to the outside world. And speaking to my wife and son on the phone. There is a phone in the cell. You have to get credit for it. And they're fleecing the prisoners, actually. It's very expensive. But getting to speak to them every day was essential as well. Was amazing. Those connections to the outside were hugely important.
Yeah. And I remember seeing some of your, you know, sketches that you had done when you were in the prison. We'll post a link to those sketches in the show notes as well. So if you'd like to check out what prison looked like from the inside for Sam Griffiths, yeah, please do check out those beautiful drawings that, you know, Sam has made. Tell us about these drawings. Like, what made you draw your space?
Well, it was something to do. I did a few things that I wrote an awful lot in there. I wrote a lot. I wrote quite a lot of letters, which I never write letters, but I really enjoyed writing letters, and then responses to emails. And then also I wrote an account of the whole experience. I started kind of halfway through and then wrote like all the way along. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with that, but it was just really helpful to get that out of my head. But part of that was also drawing and just capturing the environment. So the first drawing I did was just of the inside of the cell from my view on the top bunk. And I was using the inside of a, or the outside of an envelope that some of the emails had come in. And the window of the envelope I made to coincide with the cell of the door. And the lovely thing about the window is it's open. So that was a way of imagining, you know, that being open. And I sent it to Sari with a letter and then asked her to put some backgrounds in it. So she made a lovely sky that is in the background of it now. What I didn't try quite capture there was just the feeling of the space. So then I managed to order a couple of things through Canteen, which is their system as a touchscreen things. And you have money on your account and you can buy snacks. And I bought a reading lamp, and then the reading lamp didn't come with battery, so it never worked. But the box I opened up, and then I just adjusted the proportions of it a bit and made them the same or very similar to the cell, and then drew the interior of the cell on the inside of the box. And it just means you can fold up one corner or a couple of corners and get a real feeling for actually what it feels like spatially. That was good to articulate. But both those drawings, I was able to spend a lot of time just noodling the details, and that was just quite therapeutic and a nice activity to do. And then I did one drawing outside, looking from the landing down the wing. And I was a bit more nervous about doing that drawing because I was outside of the cell, so those other people could see you drawing. And I'd done quite a lot of work to be as invisible as possible, really. So this was me taking more of a risk about, like, but in the end, it was all fine. And I had quite a few people coming up and having a look and taking an interest. You know, this was officers and other fellow prisoners. And had some really great chats off the back of it, you know. So this was towards the end of me being in there, and I was starting to feel more, you know, confident in the environment, I think, and able to kind of, yeah, I was still kind of really quite careful about what I did and what I said where. But I'm great. I'm glad I was a little bit braver and did, you know, did something demonstrably creative in there, because it's like there were very few opportunities for people to do that. That was good. And I also really wanted to capture the building, because it's a kind of amazing structure. There are six wings off a central core. I think that it's a panopticon, is the style. So it means that when you're in the center, you have visibility of everything in the prison. So panopticon, I think, is everything, and seeing is the Greek root of that, I think. We're on the fourth level, and there's three levels underneath you. And then the wing extends quite far. It's just quite grand, really. It's quite an amazing structure.
Wow. So after what you went through, after all this, was it worth it?
Yes. For me, absolutely. I think the present thing was a shock, but it really, really connected to a lot of people. A lot of people, like within the community, but a lot of people who were on the edges of it and aren't directly part of Just Stop Oil, like wrote to me and were moved by the action that I had taken and moved to write, but also emotionally moved, I think. And that felt very meaningful to me. So I also think, like us being, there were 10 of us who were remanded and put in prison during this phase. And 13 people had tags put on, so were under house arrest during this phase as well. But us taking that step and having this experience, it does help communicate and shame this government. You know, it betrays their lack of care and compassion and their callousness. And it also helps communicate this horrible slide towards the right. And, you know, I don't use the word fascist legislation lightly, you know, but these are real freedoms that we've held, that are very long held, and we're losing them. And we're losing them because the government wants to silence dissent. It wants to silence the people who are ringing the alarm loudest. And that should scare everyone, you know. By taking this step, by putting ourselves at risk, and consequently myself being put in prison, it helps highlight what's happening. And I've had lots of very constructive conversations off the back of it about that prison experience and the situation that we now find ourselves in. So I think, all in all, I think it was worth it, and it was a valuable experience in a few different ways. But the most important feeling I had was one of huge empowerment, because up until that point and before taking action, I'd always felt utterly hopeless. No, not hopeless, helpless in the face of what we face in terms of climate collapse. It feels like so huge, and we're so small. I mean, what can we do? And also in the face of a state that doesn't care and is actively destroying things, like what can we actually do with that? But actually stepping into arrest, I felt I did do something and I was part of something, and I felt my personal power in that moment, and I felt a connection to collective power as well, which is actually more important. Because I think we're 7 billion people struggling with this, all feeling we're alone in it. And we are until we come together. We turned that thought into a sticker, which just says, you know, the question is, what can we do? I'm just one person. And the answer is, don't be one person. And it doesn't matter which group you become part of, but the really important thing is become part of a group that's doing something about this. This isn't just a cause. This isn't just another thing that would be a nice to have or a better way, a slight kind of tweak on society. This is existence. This is, you know, this is an absolutely existential threat to everything that you know and love. And yes, that's overwhelming, but it's much better to actually engage with that and realize the severity of it and look it right down the barrel. And by taking collective action, that's enabled me to do that. And I can sleep now, because I was spending years distracting myself from what's happening. Just society's built for that. It's built for all of these distractions. But it's much better to actually live with the the grief and the awful reality, but in a mode where you can do something about it. And the only way we can do something about it is through collective action and working in community. And that's what we desperately need. I think it's what we also desperately emotionally need is to connect to others. The state of neoliberal capitalism that we live in is all about individualizing us, and boxing us, separating us. We're much more profitable to sell to in that way. So that's why it's happened, but it's destroying us, you know, and we need to come together, emotionally, but also in action.
You know, we're both designers, and you know, we both design for other humans, you know, to take on our you know, human-centric lens. What can we do as these human-centric problem solvers to bring people together, to turn, you know, individuals into this collective?
I think, and this is where I might be getting to slightly controversial stuff, and I might be completely inaccurate with this. So the caveats aside, because I've not been in the design industry for a long time, but the thing I felt when I was in the industry is that designers are a little bit myopic, and they're very focused on the problems that they want to solve, and that makes them really good at what they do. But I think we need to get our heads up, and we need to be engaging in the wider context. And it's not good enough just to be a good designer and to do the best job you can. It's not good enough to be a great craftsperson and kern things better than anybody else can, or choose the best typefaces. Or be using the best tools. I think we can, as designers, we get a little bit too obsessed about the details, and I think we have to be thinking bigger picture. That means just kind of getting our heads up and looking around and really engaging with what's happening around us. So I think that's one plea to designers generally, is like really look at what you're doing and think about what the ends are of what you're doing. If I'm asking, my wish list for designers as well would be, you know, another one would just be to prioritize meaning over money. So really connect to something that is in your heart and work for that. And you know, we have access, and we are, you know, design is a superpower, and we just have to be using it for something that's constructive. And I think a lot of the work I've done, looking back on it, there's some things I'm very proud of, but there's a whole lot of it that was just about making the economic wheel turn. And that's not good enough right now, because making the economy turn is just perpetuating the status quo that is destroying everything. So this is what I mean by we have to kind of step back and step above, take a helicopter view of what we're doing. We might be doing an absolutely amazing job in the context of what we're doing, but you doing an amazing job is, like, if you look at the wider context, actually quite destructive. This is really hard stuff, and I'm sure there's people going to be screaming at this, thinking, like, you're asking too much, and I've got to pay the mortgage, and all of these things are true. But I do think that when you engage with that, if you can connect to something that is deeply meaningful to you, you will do better work, and you will do work that's better for everyone. That would be my plea. Is like, and I think one of the routes for doing that is stopping. So take a sabbatical, stop for two months, and give yourself a chance to really think and feel, and engage with what's happening in the world. Because I think the other thing that we're doing as busy people is we have lots of urgent things in inverted commas that are crowding for our attention. And just if you can stop, you can actually, you can really engage with the state of things and what's actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I can definitely relate to a lot of what you're saying. And also, it takes a lot of courage to be able to stop and zoom out from your day to day. And this is from my own personal experience. The reason I got into design was so that actually I could use my creativity and my craft to build products that would actually help people do good things for the world. But as I grew in my own career, as I started taking on new clients, new job titles, somewhere along the way I kind of lost that mission because. There was this shiny new things like a nice paycheck, a nice job title, career progression. And you just get kind of sucked into this wheel of comfort that is very difficult to get out of. And after I moved to London, for example, like I was in a unique situation of, being a non-UK citizen, being sponsored by my, employers. And, it was very, very difficult to get out of that, the golden handcuffs in a way, to then think of like what matters to me in the grand scheme of things. What would you recommend? What advice would you give to designers or anyone working in technology, product development, any of those big industries? What is the smallest step that they can take? Let's say today, right? What is the smallest step they can take today to start something in motion, over the long run?
To start, what kind of thing, Nirish? What kind of thing are you imagining? Or is it just like to start reformulating their relationship to their work?
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say here is, a lot of us, we know what is the right thing to do, but we don't do it, right? We all know like we need to, exercise regularly every week, drink lots of water, not smoke, not drink, and so on. But we don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a few suggestions. I think it's really interesting you framing it in that way and hearing about your experience. I think money and status are traps. I think you're completely right about that golden handcuffs thing. So thinking about that is really valuable. I think comfort is a really interesting one, and I think using discomfort as a compass, as part of your moral compass, is really useful. I think we know a lot in our work where certain things are quite uncomfortable to do, but they're often the most valuable. So that might be in terms of workshops or difficult conversations you've got to have. The discomfort is a signal that's of worth. Not to be too masochistic about it, but I think that's absolutely true about like taking the action I've taken is like lots of it is actually really quite uncomfortable to do, but that signals its worth. I think one thing I'd urge everyone to do is just read less is more. So that's a very good encapsulation of, what's wrong with the economy. And also like the second half is all about, well, how can we fix it? So that's really great context. So reading that would be a really good move. I think, taking some time off is really good, even if it's just a day or a week or a little sabbatical, just really give yourself a bit of space to actually think about your relationship with your work and what you're doing. And just really interrogate that question, you know, what the fuck am I doing? You know, it's an important one. It's not, I think it's the most important question you could be asking yourself right now, and really interrogate it. And I think that can be done, you know, over a lunchtime, but, you know, so you could really start engaging with that straight away. And I think it's so worth it really interrogating, like, well, am I a bit trapped by what I'm doing? And am I connecting to stuff that really is important to me? Those are like absolutely vital questions. But I do think you need time to kind of digest that and process it and really work through it. What else would be good? Oh, and then the other thing is like, talk to your neighbors. So try and break down that thing of us being a little bit isolated. I think one of the things we're really going to need over the next couple of decades is resilience. That's both personally and in terms of our communities. So start now, talk to your neighbors, get to know them, make friends with your local community, join groups that are based in there. Think about growing your own food. These are things that we really need to engage with and be working on collectively. So start by like talking. If you don't know your neighbors, get to know them. And if you don't know the people on your street, get to know them. Throw a street party. Try and get those local relationships. Just foster those local connections, because I think they're going to be incredibly valuable. We're going to need them.
When I bump into my neighbors, the only thing I say is, hey, how are you going? What's the second thing I should say to start that conversation?
Well, I think everyone actually hates small talk, you know, so really, you know, so talk to them about this stuff, you know, invite them in for a cup of tea and and it's difficult, but I do think it's really valuable. And again, there's a discomfort there because, you know, being British means you never talk about anything of substance. But it's really good when you do, you know, and people, I think actually lots of people are dying to be able to talk about this stuff. And everyone, I think everyone in their bones knows the current system is fucked. And we need to be talking about that. We need to be talking about like, how do we come together? How do we do things better? How can we bypass the current systems and the elites that are running things so badly? You know, so I think all of those conversations are super valuable.
Yeah. So, you know, little actions you can take first of all, to create space in your own environment and your own head to be able to zoom out and see the bigger picture. In terms of like, where are you heading through the actions you're taking right now? And what really matters to you? And then expanding that circle to include the people closer to you. That could be, you know, people you live with or people, you know, your neighbors, potentially colleagues.
I love that phrase, expanding the circle. I mean, that's exactly what humanity needs to do, you know. This is the work that we need to do, like collectively, is expand the circle, like in our lives with our families and friends, with our local communities, and then with nations and across borders. You know, we've radically got to expand the circle of empathy and connection. But we can start right now with our neighbours. You know, and I think, you know, talking to your neighbours is a radical act right now because we are so disconnected. And it was one of the posters from the 1968 student uprising. If you're not familiar with them, look them up. The students had a whole part of the art school that were just day and night printing silkscreen posters, putting them around Paris. And they're absolutely amazing. But one of them, just the headline is talk to your neighbours. It was a radical act then, it's a radical act now, but it's a really good place to start. And then I think the other thing is if you feel like I was and am, you know, like in a panic about what we are doing with the climate and what we need to do, is join a group. So just go to a welcome talk and find out a little bit more about how they operate and find something that you resonate with. There's a lot of groups out there and they're all doing things in different ways. They're all taking action in different ways. Find what connects to you. So that's another way that you can be not one person, you know, be part of a group. Because we desperately need collective action. And say, it doesn't matter what the group is, it's just join one and start doing things.
Mm. There is definitely more power in being part of a group than, you know, being an individual. And sometimes we can't, like you said, we can feel so powerless because we just, you know, we might be thinking about a lot of these issues that we care about, you know, not just climate change, but could be, you know, so many other, you know, issues that matter to people. But we might feel too powerless or helpless to take that first step towards maybe even having a simple conversation.
Yes, but you can start anywhere. And also, there were some really good posts that went out at New Year about, like, what, you know, 20 things you could be doing that were in climate. And taking action is just one of them. But there were some really constructive things. If you are working in a deeply corporate environment, working less is also a radical act, you know. Don't do any overtime, and maybe work fewer days a week. You know, that is, you know, if you know the work you're doing is toxic, do less of it. You don't need to kind of jump into doing something completely straight away. But there are those kind of things are powerful. And also that, by stepping back a little bit, that gives you a little bit more space to actually think about, well, what do I really want to be doing with my time?
Yeah, this is really fucking up with my mental model here in terms of how I think about, you know, work ethics and what I've been trained to do as a worker, like always give you 110% and, you know, always be your best and do your best and, you know, go for that promotion and whatever. But I need to get used to this concept of working less as a radical act. It's fucking up my brain right now.
And I think actual rest is a radical act. You know, there's a organization in the US called the NAP Ministry, and their whole thing is about actually, you know, it's very toxic, the framing we have at the moment around work and giving your all to it and deriving all your meaning through work. I don't think there's too much meaning in a lot of work. There are proxies for meaning, and the proxies are money and status and maybe awards and also that kind of feeling of a job well done and the craft that you've done, but they're proxies for real meaning. So I think that's the thing I come back to is like, what do you actually really connect to? And once you have connected to that, you'll be so much more engaged with what you're doing than you are if you don't have that kind of engagement with meaning.
I love that.
The interesting thing that's happened for me, like with Just Up Oil, is now when I'm designing for Just Up Oil. So I've come full circle. I've come back to doing...
Back to your craft.
You know. Yeah, back to the craft. But also, you know, I'm doing like lots of, you know, quite run-of-the-mill, practical, day-to-day things that just enable things to function. So a lot of it is kind of what we might think of as like bread and butter work, but because it's connected to something that I'm deeply emotionally connected to, I derive a huge sense of meaning from that work that I'm doing, and try and make this the work I'm doing as good as it can be. I've always tried to do that, but now there was a real engine for that, and that comes from like connecting to something of real value.
Love it. So, Sam, throughout this experience, you have had to experience a lot of confrontation. You know, confrontation while starting off, you know, with the public, with the authorities, with the judges, you know, with prison officials. So, you know, from my own personal point of view, I've always been scared of confrontation. I've always been taught to be nice, you know, play nice. So if you care about something, but you're too scared to, scared of confrontation, what can I do?
Yeah, I think I spent a lot of my life being scared of it too. You know, I think as designers, a lot of us, and I definitely include myself in this, are inveterate people pleasers. You know, we can't help ourselves, you know, but I think this is part of taking a bigger view on things. Is like, how constructive is being, in quotes, nice? You know, there are things that we must act on and that we must communicate. And those things are difficult to talk about, and they're challenging, and it means actually upsetting people and talking about having to live our lives in different ways. I think the counter to that is there's also lots of positive things you can be talking about because of those changes. But that's not to minimize that these are difficult conversations. And I think part of those challenging conversations is embracing confrontation and seeing the value of it. There are things happening right now that we cannot accept, you know, because they're so unjust. And we've had 40 or 50 years of people asking nicely, like saying, look, please, look, it just makes sense. We have to be looking after the environment. We have to be respectful of other people. The problem with that is asking nicely doesn't work. You know, we've had the whole kind of lobbying side of things. I respect, but it's just not up to the job, especially with the timescales we have. So I think we really have to interrogate what has to happen. We have to think very clearly about what has to happen. And then we have to think about like articulating it and speaking to people. So this comes back to those conversations with your neighbors, like talking about these more difficult topics, these more difficult conversations, does involve some level of confrontation. But there's real value in it. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, I find, you know, what you've done very inspirational because, I have to be honest, I probably wouldn't have had the same kind of level of courage that you have displayed in going through a lot of the experience that you've gone through. And I'm sure you have inspired a lot of people through your actions. And I'm hoping that this plants seeds in people's minds, bodies, and souls to then want to not just care, but actually take their own action for the things that you know they care about. So, yeah, Sam, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience and your insights from what you've gone through.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I really appreciate it. Could I just add one final thought? I think none of us who are taking this action are braver than anyone else, I think. But I think one of the things that I've really learned is about stepping through fear. So you're still afraid, but you step into it. And then I also spoke about empowerment. That's where it comes from. So knowing that something's going to be difficult and doing it anyway, and living with that discomfort and living with the fear is hugely empowering once you've done it. And then you know you can do it and you can do it again, but you don't become braver, but you become more used to like living without fear and stepping into it.
Yeah. Being used to the discomfort, because the discomfort doesn't go away. It's just that we get more resilient to it.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I think the key takeaway from this conversation for me has been about taking time to stop and reflect on what matters to you, rather than, I guess, like what you said around being myopic and just, you know, being part of your daily routine. It can be so easy and comfortable to just get sucked into that. But is it actually taking in a direction that really matters to you? And being able to take, even if it's just a day, out of that to see, yeah, what really matters and where is it that you actually want to take your life? And then, like we said, expanding that circle beyond yourself, because a lot of times we might be thinking, hey, I'm just one person, what can I do? And like you said earlier, don't be one person. Maybe like make it two. Maybe speak to someone you know about it, about what you're feeling, what you're going through, and see how that resonates or lands with them. Whether that's talking to your neighbors, joining a community, a group that actually is working on some of these issues that you care about. I also love what you said around how working less is a radical act, something I need to kind of think of how I can do this in a practical sense as well. And also thank you for sharing your memories and your vision of, you know, what prison was for you. I think it's something that a lot of us, you know, never get to experience. And just being able to see through your eyes can be very eye-opening there. Stepping through fear. Maybe sometimes the fear never goes away, but we just got to get used to that, the discomfort that fear brings, and be resilient so that we can achieve the meaning that we seek as human beings. And thank you for walking the talk and showing us the way through your actions, Sam. It's been so inspiring to see your journey throughout this whole process. And I would like to wish you all the best for the next part of your journey as you fight for your cause and hopefully take more and more people along in this journey.
Yes, our cause.
Absolutely, our cause. So if people want to reach out to you or follow your work or connect with you, how can they do that?
Well, I'm at Griffix, which is GRIFFICS on Instagram. My website is griffix.com. And then I'm doing a lot of work for Just Stop Oil, as mentioned. So check out their website, which is juststopoil.org.
Amazing. We'll put those links in the show notes. And we will see you again soon, Sam. So what did you think of the conversation? What's the one thing that stood out to you? And feel free to drop me a line if you'd like to share any thoughts or ideas or maybe suggestions for any topics or guests that you'd like to see. See you next time.